It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The debates are over. Now the presidential candidates are racing to the finish line. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Third presidential debate is behind us. And perhaps the most notable moment came this week when Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump suggests that he might not accept a defeat at the polls. He says he will keep the nation in suspense. Republican standard bearer has seen his polls slide, beginning with the first debate, but it was the tape from Access Hollywood that appears to created the political turbulence that he's finding difficult to navigate. On the tape, he jokes about what is considered to be sexual assault, but his denial at the second debate that he had committed any such acts brought as many as 9 women forward to say he had done just that. And much of this has overshadowed the continuing WikiLeaks revelations from Hillary Clinton's campaign that could have knocked off any other candidate. Say Clinton has steadily climbed to about a 7-point lead in some polls and as much as double digits in others. So what does all this mean as we head into the final weeks of the campaign? With us in our studio, we have our usual suspects, John Barkovich, the former chair of the Wicomico County Republican Central Committee, also Mike Prettle with the local Democratic Club, and Salisbury University political science professor Michael Lofton. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Good morning.
So I want to turn to perhaps the most immediate event that caught my attention, which of course, the Al Smith dinner last night. And it's unlike previous years, it seems as if it was a very dark. These were clearly not happy warriors that showed up. Just a couple of remarks. Trump talked about Clinton. She's here tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics. Clinton, for her part, was pretty tough as well, suggesting that Donald Trump sees the Statue of Liberty and he sees a 4 or maybe a 5 as she loses the torch and tablet and changes her hair. And there's a quote actually from CNN commentator Mitt Romney's former aide, Kevin Madden, who said that 2016 is ruining everything in its wake. I'll start with you, John. Just the tone of the campaign, we'll get into some of the issues. It just seems as if this thing has degenerated into an atmosphere that I haven't seen even in recent years. What's your assessment? Why has this happened, do you think?
Well, it's happened a lot because of Donald Trump's personality. I mean, there's no question he is not a politician and doesn't know the political way things are done, and that's what's made him this unique candidate. And he also is not afraid to say things that many other politicians aren't, in terms of personal attacks, basically, on his opponent's background, things she's done in the past, history, etc. And so I think it became very personal very early on for both of them. She was constantly attacking his ability and the possibility of him being president as being something that would be wrong, and him attacking her for dishonesty, lying, et cetera, et cetera. So it became very personal very early on. And it's also been, the media has, in some respects, driven a lot of this because it has become front page stuff that he feels like he has to fight against. And so it's not a political campaign that we're used to seeing. And I think part of that is because we have two very unique candidates. On both sides, we have Hillary Clinton, who has lots of skeletons in her closet, many of which are public knowledge. And then we have another candidate who has, from the beginning, not been political in his speech and political in his approach to winning the presidency. And I think that's probably where most of that comes from. And it was evidenced last night, very sharp attacks from both, stabbing wounds as opposed to tickling with a feather. And I think that's just an example of what's going to be going on over the next 15 days primarily. Because in spite of the polls and things, a lot of people haven't made their decision yet. And many people, we know from past experience, a lot of people don't make their decisions until they walk into the polling place. So there's still opportunity for both sides to substantially change what the current numbers are.
Mike Prettle, what do you make of this tone? I mean, is it simply that Donald Trump has this personality, or there was a decision certainly on the part of the Clinton campaign to go after the issue of temperament, and as she, as a matter of fact, hit that over and over again, talked about how he's unfit, even compared him to, say, Mitt Romney or John McCain, who said, well, I've had, say, differences with those people, but I never thought I would say this. That's a pretty devastating and personal blow to your opponent.
Well, I think certainly the story for the year has been Donald Trump. You know, and the one area where I disagree with John strenuously is that I think Hillary Clinton is the epitome of the Democratic Party. I think she is, I mean, she's not an unusual candidate by any means. I think she is probably the most qualified Democrat to be running for an election for the highest office. And I don't think she's out of the mainstream at all. And frankly, I happen to think she's a good candidate. And I think she's been demonized by the Republicans, done very skillfully, and has put her in a situation where, you know, she's dishonest, where she's nasty, where she does this, that, and the other, where I think she's a good, solid Democratic candidate. You know, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, Obama's population is soaring. You know, he's at the highest level that he's been for a while and that most presidents are when they leave office, you know. And Hillary will follow his path, and yet people say, gee, we need a change. The country's in terrible shape. Well, how's that consistent with Obama's popularity, you know? And then you have Michelle Obama, who is off the charts as far as popularity is concerned, and she's backing Hillary very strongly. You know, so anyway, I think the Democrats are running a good race, and you know, and the story is Trump's unusual personality. He blames the media for all his problems when it's clear that he's a media candidate. That's what they've made him. He's a media personality. That's all he is, in my judgment. And you know, he's exploited the media very skillfully in the past, but now it's catching up with him because he doesn't know how to handle it properly, and he's been saying things and doing things that that have come to light and that are going to destroy him. And unlike John, I feel the race has been over for some time, that there's no way in the world that the majority of thinking people in this democracy will vote for somebody like Donald Trump.
Of course, we still have a couple of weeks left to go here, so it's the jury's still out.
Well, but as you said, the spread is widening rather than narrowing, you know, and I mean, it's a question of whether Hillary will win handily or whether she'll win overwhelmingly. And
I suppose it's barring any WikiLeaks bomb, I guess. I'm going to turn to Michael Laughlin here, because historically, have we seen this kind of tension between candidates? I mean, wait, for instance, at the dinner, as a matter of fact, at the third debate, they didn't shake hands. Last night at the Al Smith, they finally did shake hands. It was afterwards, and what I could see, I think, was actually Trump really sort of initiated the handshake itself. She did turn around. She shook his hand. It was almost sort of perfunctory about it. And then she turned back to whoever it was that she was talking to. These are people who really don't like each other. I mean, have we seen this kind of thing before?
I think so, actually. I don't think this election is unique in electoral history. I mean, if you go back to Nixon and Kennedy, they hated each other. If you go back to McCain and George Bush, George W. Bush in the primaries, they hated each other. When you listen to some of the tapes that are run about, and one tape, as I recollect, McCain said to Bush, "Do you really have to go this low?" And this really visceral thing. So I don't actually think that that is unique. I think that the way this campaign unfolded really is a consequence in part of what the Republican Party did to Hillary Clinton's character. I mean, they have demonized Hillary Clinton over the years. And so their setup was this campaign would be about how untrustworthy she is. She lies all the time. You can't trust her. And therefore, interestingly, she is unfit from a character point of view. Put aside the issues. And essentially what the Clinton campaign decided was who can play this game. So they were hoping for Trump to be the candidate. Trump becomes the candidate. So he's temperamentally unfit. So we have this unconstructive or destructive campaign altogether that helps us quite little in terms of citizens voting on issues. Instead, we're focusing on who's least unfit to be president of the United States, which is really not very good for a democracy. Ironically, one other point I'd add is that ironically, if Trump had stayed with the issues, the trade issues and the financial and economic stagnation that a lot of people see, both on the left and the right, he would have had a much better shot, and I think this election would be much closer than it is. But playing to his major flaw, which is narcissistic personality and egomania. He was the worst messenger for the Republicans at this point in time.
Why did you get into issues? But I wanted to address one other issue that came up during the debate this week. And, of course, that was the comment by Donald Trump that when asked whether or not he would accept the results of the election, he simply said, well, he would see at the time when it happened, would keep us in suspense, as he said. He's emphasized the idea that this is a rigged election, both in terms of media, but he has also then added a second part, which, of course, was perhaps that it's going to be rigged at the ballot box. I want to turn to you, John. What was your reaction to that? And then his sort of subsequent day after sort of explanation as to what he was talking about, including the idea that he suggested, yes, he would accept the election results if he won. That was kind of start right out there. Well, and then he came, and that, as a matter of fact, that got most of the attention, I think.
I think that in the Gore Bush, Bush was winning. I don't think he wanted to address the. I'm going to let that go.
Okay.
I'll let that go. That was years ago. No, when I watched it and he said it, I got the impression when he said it and I was watching it live that he was saying, you know, there's a lot going on. He brought up the Veritas tapes and things that had happened in his rallies by bought and paid for provocateurs. He's seen recent stories about voter fraud. There are issues that are being addressed in many states, Pennsylvania, Texas, where there is evidence of voter fraud already. And so I think in that milieu to say, I today will accept the outcome without knowing what that outcome is and how that outcome was achieved, makes sense. I just don't understand why you would want to give up the ability to adjudicate issues that arose in the election that might have turned the election a different way. So I'm not surprised by what he said. I was surprised by the reaction of the media to say, oh, he's trying to bomb America and get rid of. He didn't say anything about getting rid of democracy. Democracy is based on people voting, legitimate people voting. And I think until the election is accomplished and we know how the process did go forward, I think it's legitimate for him to say, I'm not going to do anything until I see what happens.
Well, yeah, let me just follow up on that because, yeah. I mean, you got some real pushback from Republican leaders.
Oh, no,
I mean,
you know, Senator, that's what I said. I was surprised when I saw Republicans responding
I think the question becomes, why say that when you know that those are options are clearly open to you? I mean, we saw, for instance, in Bush v. Gore. Certainly, Gore was willing to accept the decision of the voters and the outcome of the election. There was some issue in Florida.
Right.
So he certainly had a right to adjudicate that. Why be so blunt as to say, well, I'm going to look at it rather than assume that, of course, if there is some issue that comes
because
up
the
in
issues
a state,
of the
why
past,
not?
The issues of the past have driven him to understand that issues may arise in this election cycle that are, again, worthy of adjudication. And I don't think to give up that ability makes any sense. Why would I do that if I was him? I'd say, if someone asked me, if I lose, I lose. But until I've been shown to lose, I'm not giving up every option I might have.
Mike Prettl?
Look, even the Republicans realize the whole voter fraud thing is the biggest pile of hooey. I mean, how many states are under the control of Democratic governors? You know, something like 31 states, I believe, and they control the electoral process in those states. All the statistics show that, you know, out of the last 3 billion votes cast, there were, I think, 18 cases of voter fraud proven. And that's been a mantra that the Republicans have played like a harp for years, and there's no proof of it. They overlooked the scandal a few years ago where the Republican U.S. attorneys were fired because they couldn't find any voter fraud, and the Bush administration insisted that they have to go out and find something, whether it existed or not. You know, I mean, the Republican leadership itself was disappointed, was frustrated, was angry when Trump raised again this mantra that he wouldn't possibly accept the election results because of the possibility of tampering. And I mean, the number of cases of voter fraud is laughable. It just doesn't happen. Sure, there are people still on the rolls who have been dead for years, but they're not going to vote. They're just on the rolls because some of the states.
They have voted in Virginia.
Oh, come on, John. I mean,
dead people have voted in Virginia.
Sure, okay,
I'm
right,
sorry,
I'm
it's
right.
True. It's a fact.
Yes, okay, John. The thought that this election would be colored seriously by any number of people voting illegally in any states is laughable. It really is. And no one, Republican or Democrat, has proven that there's been any significant impact on any election in the last quarter century or half century.
Michael Laughlin, you put on your sort of political science hat here. I mean, what about the issue of voter fraud? I mean, certainly, the most notable instance that of potential voter fraud affecting a presidential election was probably 1960 in Illinois,
right,
with a Chicago machine, right? It was one of the last great city machines
ago,
to be around, right? Yeah. Since then, we haven't had that kind of, at least outright, fraud. And it's one of the other thing I also note about voter fraud, there's not much incentive on an individual basis. You really have to organize something if that's what you're going to. And for instance, in political machines, right, it was the benefits you get, right, from the machine itself. So historically, what kind of impact has that had? And is this an unusual thing for somebody to come out and say, well, I'm going to look at it, even though we obviously know that, sure, of course, there is that right to do it.
Yeah, I guess part of the answer is no and yes. That is, that there the studies that have been done, the evidence is simply absent for voter fraud, for any kind of significant voter fraud, impersonation at the polling place. I mean, that's simply false. And for anybody to insist otherwise is simply in a fantasy world. And I think so Trump has constantly been involved, and Trump himself. Now, of course, it's always unclear. You never know what someone actually believes. So in his own world, he may believe in this, but there's no evidence to support it. I think the more important problem is the question of the legitimacy of our political institutions and our electoral process. And here, intentional or not, and I think it is intentional, but functionally speaking, for a presidential candidate to be talking about, I mean, it's not just an isolated comment. It is in a long series, a whole atmosphere that he has created of the illegitimacy of the media, the illegitimacy of the process, the illegitimacy of their Democratic Party, the illegitimacy even in the Republican Party. And all the cards are stacked against him. And by commenting in this fashion, he is therefore undermining the confidence, the legitimacy of our electoral process. Hang on, of our electoral institutions. So, for the voters, for those particularly for the folks that he has mobilized, when he says it's rigged and he's saying it's I'm going to wait, there they have to say, well, there must be something seriously wrong with the electoral process. So when he does lose, what will they conclude? It's illegitimate. I mean, he started this, of course, with birtherism, when he questioned the legitimacy of Barack Obama as president, right? And this is simply a continuation of this. Hence, I think it's proper and justified to criticize him roundly for this, because it's a reckless, at the very least, it's reckless, but I think it's intentional as well.
But it plays into the national sense. In many polls we've seen it, they don't trust government institutions.
Of course.
Okay?
And so, created that.
And, no, hold on.
Okay,
it has some reality and validity to it. Okay, we see how the VA operates, and people go, this is an example of the government just can't do anything right. And so that's part of it. So it plays into that. Okay. And it also, the rig portion, he can turn to the recent primary on the Democrat side and look, that was clearly rigged. Oh, what do you mean it was clearly rigged? Well, let's see, Donna Brazil, it's just, so there is history there. So if you tell me elections don't get rigged, you explain to me what went on in the Democratic primary. Because if it went on in the Democratic primary, it could just as easily go on in a national election.
Okay, well, I would note, by the way, that in the primaries, by the way, John, that most of the states that Sanders won were not primaries.
Understood.
They, right? Okay, which means that they were quite unrepresentative of any individual state in the elections that we know of. And I know that, Matt, for some Sanders people think that we should get rid of the caucuses. So I think when When we look at the shenanigans, one of the things I think we have to kind of look at is to step back. If they'd all been primaries, would have Sanders lost by a bigger margin? But we need to move on here.
Because I want to interject important distinction between the shenanigans of campaigns and the actual machinery of elections. Bernie Sanders never questioned the machinery of the elections.
That's right.
Okay, so he trusted the actual machinery of when people went to vote. Right, he wasn't challenging that though that they were rigging the polls. I mean, that's what you're claiming, which I think false.
There was rigging. All I'm saying is there was rigging.
Every party officials have always had favorite candidates, and that goes on all the time. It's just it came out this time.
I suppose it depends upon the
both parties, John,
the definition of rigging. But we'll get into
The Republican parties were rigged against
Okay. I want to turn
more than the Democrats are now.
I want to turn to Hillary Clinton and Wall Street speeches and her positions. She took something like, I think, $1.8 million in speeches to big banks. There were, of course, three of them that were revealed during the campaign, suggesting that she avoided direct criticism of Wall Street, took sort of a soft-handed approach in the speeches. She talked about how she had great relations working with Wall Street as a senator in New York. Said the jury was still out with Dodd-Frank, whether or not it was the right approach to the financial crisis. More openness would have prevented the uproar from Wall Street when it came to the Dodd-Frank. And I think that my favorite quote is, you guys help us figure it out, and let's make sure that we do it right this time, end quote. And I'm gonna turn to Michael Laughlin because I know he's a staunch progressive here, and a sharp critical of Wall Street and certainly Hillary Clinton. Along is what do you make of these revelations? Are they as serious as we would suggest? And I know there are a number of progressives who said this kind of proves what Sanders was talking about.
I think it does. I mean, I think it's evidence then just simply to reveal what. The allegations, the Sanders allegations were during the primaries, and that is Clinton has a long history of being quite cozy with Wall Street. And she has, I mean, it's ironic because her positions basically on trade and on the place of banks and so on is really quite similar to Paul Ryan. I mean, these two don't really disagree as a philosophical and theoretical matter. And so that these speeches really indicate her willingness to be give them plenty of access. I mean, we can anticipate that in a Clinton presidency, Wall Street folks are going to have plenty of access. They've been good allies here, and they're going to have a significant role to play in the making of policy. And this is where it will be interesting when we follow posts. I mean, when the Clinton presidency begins, because there's going to be clearly pressure on the left. Right to essentially defang that kind of leverage that the Wall Street folks are going to have. So I think on balance, it is the progressives are right to say, well, here's evidence of what we've been saying all along.
Let me talk to this because
I don't think so. Because there's a couple of things, because there was in terms of some of her advisors, I think with Mandy Greenwald, who's a consultant in October of 2015, said, I worry about defending the banks in the debates. President of the American Progress, I'm wary of the growing economic populism on center left. A lot of discussion going on about, well, okay, gee, I'm concerned. Michael, Mike Prettl, go ahead.
I read the transcripts or the data with respect to her speeches. I didn't find anything in there that I felt was at all. With due respect to my friend Michael Laughlin, I think, but a lot of my views are probably as far left as you will, and I've been called that all over the place on the. On the shore. But I mean, any leader, and especially a leader of the Democratic Party, which is a big tent, has to deal with Wall Street as well as deal with Main Street, with the people of this country, you know. And I mean, Obama's certainly doing it. Is Obama accused of having sold out to Wall Street?
Some people have.
Well, but I mean, look, Elizabeth Warren is part of that same tent, you know. I mean, that dialogue is healthy. You certainly have to meet with those people. You have to take advice from those people. You also take advice from Elizabeth Warren, and you take advice from the labor unions. You take advice from all sorts of interests which are at odds to some extent politically with each other. And then you have to reach decisions. And some of the decisions are going to be very unpopular with
you. You cannot deny, Michael, that if Bernie Sanders had not been in the campaign, if she had not been challenged from the left.
No question. I agree.
Hang on a second. She would not have changed her position on TPP. I mean, the Republicans are right to say she called it the gold standard. And for her, I mean, it's the most obvious flip-flop in politics we've ever seen. Right, that she was on board for TPP. She was supportive of Obama, and Obama is trying to push TPP. So whose power is being reflected in that trade agreement? It is not the power of labor unions.
Michael,
it is the power. Hang on a second. It's the power of banks. It's the power of open free traders.
And Paul Ryan
will support it.
And this is a reversal of exactly where it used to be. It was always the Republicans who were the big money guys. The Republicans who were had the banks and the Wall Street behind them. And it's absolutely reversed. Now we have a Republican candidate who is not on that side. He's actually on the his stand is
rhetoric.
Okay, whatever. And the Democrat, on the other hand, is now being visualized as the
Elizabeth Warren is campaigning every day for a public opinion
Hillary has a public opinion and a private opinion. And she is now seen, or at least Trump will continue to paint her, as a tool of Wall Street. And those guys out there, middle Americans, are now looking at Republicans as being side. Hold on. Because that's why he's got the support he has. And Hillary is being seen as the Wall Streeter, the tool of the banks.
Look, Hillary's life has been committed to working for the common man, working for women, working for children, working for families. I mean, she's pushing all sorts of policies that Wall Street would feel are anathema, you know, paid leave for maternity leave, that sort of thing, you know. But, I mean, that's what Democrats do. And that's what every Democrat has done in the past, you know, has worked with the power structure and has worked with the people and the unions. And, you know, I don't think there's anything unusual about the way that she's handling herself.
Except for the money she gets from the foundation. That's what she's worked on. She's worked on getting money for the Clintons.
And that's been incredible.
She's used her position to foster herself and the foundation.
That money hasn't gone to her, John. The Clintons haven't taken one penny from the
cut through the other way to the foundation. Michael Laughlin. The thing that struck me, particularly as I've read some of the speeches and I read the quotes and so on, is that she seems to be, on the one hand, and certainly her public positions in general have been fairly progressive, but she seems to be this pragmatic person. While she's telling, right, because she's trying to, when she talks to the bankers, for example, right, which we have to note she got a hefty fee for it, but when she talks to bankers, she's telling them, it seems to me, that, you know, we cannot allow this to happen again, that we need some kind of reform. And almost in essence warning them, if you don't get on board, more of the stuff is going to come down the line and we're going to have more problems and we're going to have to deal with this. Do you think that she's been tainted with that pragmatism? I mean,
I agree that she's pragmatic. And I think that given that pragmatism, and given, I think that she, I mean, I think it's potentially a case that if the banks don't self-regulate in important ways, then she would be willing to move towards greater regulation of the banks and of the financial markets more generally. But I think it's simply the history is clear. I mean, it's Bill Clinton who deregulated. It's Bill Clinton who got rid of Glass-Steagall, and that's what the banks wanted. The big banks wanted that, and they got it. And that history, and hence that kind of shift. I mean, I think you can mark the shift in the Democratic Party away from the working class people. I think that there's a lot of analysis out there now that says, well, the Democrats shifted the new Democrat. Bill Clinton was leader of the new Democrats, and they went after upper middle class professionals and where the money was. That was a decision that was made. So we are not, we're not in the FDR political party, Michael. And
I agree with
all.
Look, I agree
so,
with
so
you.
So to say, to suggest somehow all the Democrats have always done this, and she's a representative. Hang on a second. She's a representative of the working class. That's just simply false. The working class labor has access. It's going to have power here. But there's going to be a real struggle, I think.
There's always struggle, John.
More so, I mean, the access that the banks have now with the Democratic Party is significantly greater than it once was.
But we passed Dodd-Frank, and we're going to expand Dodd-Frank. And
not from the side of the Clintons, though. Look,
She has talked about additional regulations.
As a consequence of the pressure that's coming from the left.
Look, I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary. I agree with you that the triangulation, so-called, that Bill Clinton undertook was wrong, and he would admit it today, and she admits it today, okay? And I hope they don't go in that direction. I hope Bernie Sanders is going to be part of her administration.
There's any ideological mooring here.
That's the way the Democrats have worked for centuries. That's always been the process, that you've had people under the big tent, and I think Hillary's has shown that she's willing to work with both parts of
I think the party. Democratic tent has shrunk. I think the Democratic tent has lost a lot of middle America, and that's because the Democratic Party has changed, as you have described, over the last couple of cycles, and they are no longer seen as the party of middle America. And I think that's why Donald Trump's campaign has been to focus on that.
Well, let's talk about middle America a minute, because part of the problem is that the country has certainly lost its manufacturing base overseas. And Trump is a big part of that, as we know. Trump manufactures all his goods overseas, And everybody, Democrats and Republicans alike, have said, we're going to restore that. Well, they know that that's a fantasy. We're not going to restore the manufacturing base of this country.
Why not?
Because it's cheaper to manufacture in Bangladesh and
India, if you put a tariff on products from Mexico, for example, if you put a 35% tariff on cars made in Mexico coming into the United States, you know what? They'll be building plants in Detroit as fast as they can.
Intelligent, fiscally prudent economists in both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party believe that that's a mistake, okay? Free trade.
I don't believe it's
free trade is the position of both parties.
I see Michael Laughlin sort of saying, just raising hackles about free trade there.
Yeah, I agree.
Because one of the things I want to talk to John about here is on the one, you're quite right that Donald Trump has taken this position about trade, right, about the banks, about we've got to get
the wall,
Muslims.
What I'm thinking, on and on.
But particularly about the finance stuff. But the thing I'm wondering about is, okay, so let's assume that Hillary Clinton is elected president and she gets legislation written by Bernie Sanders or whatever that try to clamp down on shadow banking. How quickly, how supportive would you think, say, a Paul Ryan or the grassroots Republicans in Congress now is going to be supportive of that? I mean, because as I've always noted, NAFTA passed not because of Democratic congressional support, but because of Republican support. That's been a very traditional position. So even if we try to push towards some kind of financial reform or even trade reform policies, isn't the Republican Party going to be standing in the way? Because the Trump position is not the right. Traditional party position, is what I'm saying.
Well, of course, Trump is not traditional.
Well, that's not
Republican. Okay, I think I've made that clear this morning. Okay.
But what about that?
And again, that's why the Republican elite has not gotten behind Trump. I mean, we've seen, there were some initial lukewarm kind of endorsements, and they've all sort of fallen away because Trump is fighting against elitism in both parties. And I think that appeals to many of his voters when he says that, because the elites have not done anything to make this country better. In fact, this country is getting worse, and I want to make it great again. How are you going to do that? The policies that he's talked about, I think, will accomplish that. Now, whether he'll have the support of all Republicans, not clear, because a lot of the issues that he has described are actually against issues that the Republicans have stood for in the past, like free trade. But we have seen what free trade has done to this country. And I think the voters are saying, yeah, I agree with Trump. Free trade has hurt us. Now, can it be turned around overnight? No, I don't think so. Are there ways that it can be done slowly? Probably. But I think he's the first one to step forward and say, this is one of the reasons why we are in this terrible situation.
But doesn't that contradict the fundamental marketplace philosophy of the conservative side of the ledger and Republican Party. I mean, the Republican Party, it's a marketplace.
No question. In the past that's the case. This is a new Republican.
You think that something's going to change? I mean, you think that the Republican Party is going to... Because of the Trump voter?
Yes. If he wins, they will have to change.
And what happens if he loses?
And he will have the bully pulpit.
Let me ask you this. What happens if he loses? Those voters are still there.
Do you think there's going to be pressure? The potential for the destruction of the Republican Party if he loses is substantial. Because there's going to be left... There will be a lot of people who are saying, you know, the reason my man lost, Trump, is because my party, the Republicans, didn't support him. And so there is the potential for breakup of the Republican Party after this election, if Trump loses. If Trump wins, then I think all bets are off. All bets are off. And where we go from there is totally questionable, because I don't think anybody can tell.
Michael Upton, you're a political scientist. You've been looking at politics a long time. We've seen really only the emergence of one third party into a major party. There was the Republican Party. It was over probably the most basic fundamental flaw of the U.S. Constitution, which was, of course, was slavery. Do you see this? Do you think that there's that kind of dramatic issue that would actually break up a party, as, say, slavery clearly did with the Whigs and the emergence of the Republican Party?
At this point, I guess I don't. I mean, I think that assuming Trump does lose, I think there's certainly going to be a fragmentation and a fracturing of the Republican Party, and the consequence will be that for national elections, for say the next presidential cycle, for example, the Democrats will probably have a clear shot once again, because that there'll be sufficient fragmentation within the Republican Party, unable to mobilize behind another Republican candidate. However, I think there remains sufficient strength within the Republican Party on the conservative side for state legislatures, governorships, and Senate and House races. I mean, I don't see gerrymandering is not being undermined here, and that's certainly still in place. So I still think that hobbled, the Republican Party will still stumble forward. The long term, of course, it can't stay in that position if it wants to be remain a nationally competitive party.
Well, the real question is what Trump does after he loses. Okay, the question is whether he continues to work in politics or whether he works outside the political system. You know, if he wants to continue to be a political player, then I think it does spell perhaps the doom of the destruction of the Republican Party. There's talk now that he wants to be be another Fox channel or something. And if he does that, then he'll set himself up as another Rush Limbaugh critic of the establishment of both parties, basically. But it sort of lies in his future as to where he's going to go after he loses.
If I could just interject, I disagree on this point to this extent, that I don't think the future of the Republican Party depends simply on the part of what particular figures at any particular time are. It really depends on the constituencies of the party. And I think what Trump has done is he's ridden that tiger of a certain segment of the Republican Party that will be very unhappy with the demise of Trump. And even if Trump goes off and golfs the rest of his, that constituency is mobilizable, so that the alt-right folks, I mean, in that there will be other candidates
but
who come along.
Most of the Tea Party will go back to the Republican Party.
This is not simply the Tea Party.
I think John's right about that.
Yeah, it's much more than the Tea Party.
This is people who have not paid attention because they've lost interest in national politics.
Because I've voted
in the past,
yeah, I think that's true.
And my person got elected, and he's done nothing for me. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of those people have been left out of the political scene entirely. Mm-hmm. And this guy comes forward and says, I want you. I understand what you're saying. I agree with you. You have been badly treated by the elite of both parties. And you come with me, and we're going to change it. We're going to go to D.C., and we're going to change it. And I think that's very appealing to some people who have not been involved, neither Republican or Democrat. They've just been on the outside, sort of, I'm not either, because no matter what I do, nothing happens. It only gets worse for me. I'm spending, I have two jobs. I can't pay for my health insurance. You know, on and on and on. They're not involved because they've learned in the past, no matter how they vote, nothing gets better for them. And this guy comes forward and says, you know what? I'm going to make your life better. I'm going to turn this country around. I'm going to bring jobs back. I'm going to turn our deficit around. I'm going to make America great again. And that's appealing to some people who feel like they've been totally left out of the political process. They've had no input. And when they have had input, nothing gets changed.
These are people who have been told, John, that the government is bad. And they've been told that for the last 20 or 30 years.
There are many segments of government that are bad.
Although this seems to be spread. This isn't just about government anymore. This is also about big business. And I think that's the other thing that's really, I mean, people, and because, you know, because free trade is big business.
Trump jumped on Ford when they announced they were moving their plant to Mexico. He jumped on Ford big time. He jumped on Carrier for the same thing.
So one of the questions I have, sort of bringing maybe locally, is Congressman Andy Harris, who, by the way, he voted against the fast tracking for TPP because he didn't trust the current president. Is there a possibility that, say, 2 or maybe 4 years from now, someone like Congressman Andy Harris, who certainly is a free trader, at least in the past. I mean, I know he hasn't been in Congress that long, but he certainly shares that philosophy. Is it possible there could be a potential challenge to him on the basis of things like the trade and the banks and so on that say, hey, I don't like the fact that, you know, you're siding with these guys, and that's assuming, of course, that he cast those kinds of votes. But do you think it's possible in a district like this?
In answer to your question, I think yeah. Andy Harris has the job for as long as he wants.
I just don't see somebody bubbling up. This district
is too conservative, and as long as he maintains his conservative credentials, he'll have the job as long as he wants. Now that's still different from the Republican Party as a whole. And that's where I've sort of been alluding to today, is I don't think the Republican Party as a whole has been able to maintain their stands, and it's changed because of the guy at the top of the ticket.
The other problem for the Republican Party, however, is that unless they get rid of the bigotry that's been part of their whole rhetorical approach, they're just going to continue to recede as a minor party. Because they must get, in the future, Latino American votes, and they must get African American votes.
But I think Trump has made more approach in that than any Republican candidate ever.
He's successful as a ticket.
To the contrary, Trump has trumpeted the bigotry of what the Republican Party has been using ever since Richard Nixon, I would say. And so he has made the situation worse. So Clinton is the gap in terms of the Latino vote, in terms of African-American vote, and the women's vote, right? It's going to be huge. It's going to be much bigger than it was with Obama and Romney. And what does that tell the Republican leaders? Do you want a national party, or are you happy with being the moon?
Well, they did this refix after the last election, and they said, hey, we're now going to outreach, and how's that work out? When I saw
Trump go to Detroit.
And he said, that's my African-American over there.
I thought that was a singular step for a Republican candidate in a national campaign. I hadn't seen that kind of thing. I didn't see that from Romney. I didn't see that from McCain. And it didn't work, John.
That remains to be seen.
Although I will admit, I know that Michael Laughlin was shaking his head. I will admit, I was struck by the fact, A, that Trump made any attempt to address African-American concerns, however critical one might be of them, and how, no matter how selective his appearances were.
But you're implying that African-Americans,
Hispanics, the minorities, don't have the same concerns that middle-class white Americans have. That's my job, my safety, my health insurance.
What is this racist tone to everything,
not,
John?
That's not racist to say I'm going to make it better for everybody.
I think one of the things, maybe you've already answered my question here, because there is this demographic change that's occurring.
No question.
The white vote is something like it's now 72%. Right. At time Reagan was elected, it was like 85%, and it's diminishing. And by I think it's 2050, it's going to be 50% or below. So how do you see the Republican Party adapting to that demographic change, given there's certainly an anti-immigrant strain, particularly attached to the Hispanic community? We saw that happen, for instance, in California. The birtherism certainly didn't help, but there's been, as Michael Lofton has pointed out, there was a decision many years ago, particularly coming out of Nixon, to forego the African-American vote. Now you have to kind of go back to it. There is this change that's going on. Even Asian Americans are not necessarily they're also turning Democratic. How does the Republican Party deal with this demographic change? Because it's had a great run in terms of, you know,
I don't think the issues are different for Hispanics and for whites. Why do you think those groups see that
that there is some difference?
Because that has been the way it has been driven in the past.
You don't think that comes from personal experience?
Oh, some of it may be from personal experience, but that's the way it's been. That's the milieu and the push that we've seen for years and years. Okay, and so this guy comes forward, Trump, and he has a different approach entirely. And so he is not the typical candidate. And so I think that has made Hispanics, African Americans, and other minorities look at this guy differently than they have Republicans in the past, because he's not a Republican. He's not an old-fashioned Republican. He's a new Republican. And so that's why when you say, oh, he's not going to get the woman vote, that remains to be seen, because there are some polls to suggest that he's probably going to do a lot better than people are saying right now.
He says the inner city's a hellhole.
And you know what people say? You're right.
I grew up.
Okay, if you look at how many people
do, but not the black people.
If the black people in Chicago are just as dissatisfied about the number of deaths that have occurred in that city as white people.
But they don't consider their city to be.
They're the ones getting killed, and they're the ones that want it stopped.
And they don't consider their city to be a hellhole, John. And that's that.
I don't know. You ask a mom who's 6 years old, just got shot on the side of the road.
I grew up in Baltimore. You go to Baltimore, you think people there think it's a hellhole? I mean, you're living in Trump's fantasy world.
Well, there are serious issues, though.
Well, there are issues.
I think the real question is whether or not, and I think it goes to John's point, is the Republican Party offering solutions to those problems, right? That's the basic question,
because
it's not enough to say, it seems to me, it's not enough to say the Democrats haven't done anything, they don't really care, they just come every 4 years. No, they've invested a lot of time and effort, and whatever solutions, and whether you want to criticize the solutions, are fine, right?
Right.
The question I have is what the Republican solution is and whether or not it's going to appeal to those people. I mean, for instance, House Speaker Paul Ryan, he's kind of tussling with some of this now, as opposed to the old 47%.
Well, he's giving lip service to it, but is he really suggesting we implement any policies to change things? You know, are they willing to put money into the inner city in any meaningful way to change things? I don't see that.
I think Donald Trump has said education is the key, one of the keys, and I think he said we're going to have charter schools, we're going to give parents the option of putting their kids in a school that has success rather than a school that's driven with mediocrity and failure. And so education, strong point. Law and order, strong point. Bringing jobs and the economy back is going to help everybody. And I think people in the hell holes understand that some of the things that he's talking about may help me and my family. If I had a better job, my kids had a better school to go to, things might be better. And I'm in the hell hole. I don't carry a gun. I want to be protected, and I need police to do that. And I don't think those things are lost on the communities, the minority communities in these places.
Well, John, you'll see what the votes are. But
well, I mean, we'll see. I think he's making an appeal that other Republicans have not made.
And certainly, I happen to agree with John. I think it's a really interesting appeal, particularly certainly for the African American community. I'm not so sure about this.
I don't want to get off on charter schools, but a lot of African Americans see a charter school is just a way to destroy the public school system in the major cities. You know,
in major cities is already destroyed.
John, but that's we're talking about perception now. We're talking about votes. We're talking about what people want to do, and there is not a big push in any of the cities that I know of for all the African Americans say, hey, we need more charter schools. They see charter schools as a threat, not as a solution.
That's
a white solution to the black problem, okay? if you will.
Well, okay. So, okay, let's turn to the election prospects here.
Okay.
So we have a number of polls that have indicated, certainly at this moment, that that Clinton is ahead. There was of the last debate poll, CNN did those who were watching, so it was slightly Democratic, by the way, 52% Clinton, 39% Trump. I was looking at, for instance, Nate Silverman, we were still looking at the 538 organization, looking at polls overall, and before the first debate, Clinton was ahead by about 0.15%. After the second debate, it was up to 5.6%. Before the third debate, it was at 7.1%. John, where do you see this going in terms of these polls? I was looking at some of the polls, for instance, for the battleground states. At this point, we're a few weeks out yet. Trump is behind. That is that Clinton sometimes as 6%. Where do you assess this campaign, and what has Trump got to do to try to weave that narrow path?
Well, I mean, part of it is money. Okay, the Clinton campaign has spent a ton of money on TV advertising in the swing states, and that has had some effect on the polls where they stand now, I believe. There have been the issues that, you know, the tapes and all that,
right,
with Trump. I mean, but that's all sort of going away. And I think as we get closer and closer to the election, then people are going to start to pay more and more attention. That's always what happens. And so the next couple of weeks for Trump are critical. I think Trump has to keep pushing on what I'm going to do for America, how I'm going to, don't just say, let's make America great again. He's got to say how he's going to do it. And I think he has some proposals and policies that will appeal. And when they go into that voting booth, I'm not sure they're going to remember that TV ad that they saw 3, 4, 6 weeks ago. They're still going to make that decision of, I'm dissatisfied with where I am. Who's the one that's more? I there's a lot of voters who I don't like either of them. But when they get into that polling place and they go, which of these two are going to be more likely to give me what I need, which is change, a positive change, I'm hoping that final poll will be the one that counts. The polls now, I still don't know what they mean. Hmm. And it depends on who does them and how they do them and who they ask. And as I've described before, I think there are going to be a lot of voters that show up in November who've never voted before, who are on nobody's radar. Nobody's asking them. And if they show up in November, things might be different than the polls now describe.
But do you think, because one of the things I've noticed, I was watching at some of these focus groups, and, you know, they do the little dials,
right,
that register. And when Trump started talking about, like, immigration or trade, right? I mean, both men and women, that their approval rating went up.
Particularly independents,
right,
too.
And by the way, these were actually undecided voters.
Right.
And when he then started on a personal attack, he called her a liar or something like that, then suddenly it just dramatically dropped.
Right.
So one of the questions, I guess, I have drawn from that is Trump disciplined enough to hit those issues to try to bring this back around?
That.
I mean, it's what do you think?
No,
John?
I think everybody's telling. I mean, you don't see any pundit out there saying anything other than Trump needs to focus on policy. And the last debate, he came much closer to that than he did on the first two. And that, and again, I thought he won the third debate because he did speak to policy more. And I think if he can do that between now and election, I think he can draw a lot of people to the polls to vote for him based on his policies. Because I think the policies that Hillary has put forward are not those that are going to help the middle America, because she's being perceived as the money candidate. She's the one with the banks behind her. She's the one who has the public and the private opinion. And that's my hope, okay? That's what I think and hope will happen November 8th.
Well, I think we all agree that nothing in this election this whole campaign has focused on policy. And, I mean, the Republican consultants that I heard before the last debate said that this was Trump's last gasp hope to turn things around if he could focus properly on policy. And I agree with that it is an area where he has scored some points in the past. But I think after the first 10 minutes, he blew it, basically. And, you know, and instead of his poll figures going up, his poll figures are going down. And I heard Montero on public radio just on my way down here saying that even if Trump wins all the swing states, he still isn't going to win. He can't get the electoral votes, which is really the key to the whole thing. So, I mean, I think it's over. 16 days from now, we'll know whether it's over or not. But I think that there's virtually nothing that Trump can do to dispel.
Well, see, that's what the media wants people to believe, that it's all over. And I don't think it's over by a long shot. And so the media has pushed forward.
John, with all due respect, the media have kept this thing alive by focusing on Donald Trump, who's gotten 10 times the coverage that Hillary Clinton got.
And very little of it positive.
John, go ahead.
Well, there's nothing positive to say.
Go ahead, John.
Well, I can't get away from the media aspect of this. And Trump has made a big deal about this and continues to. And I think he will right up until the end. Because I think the media has been seen as so biased that even people who don't pay attention are starting to realize that they have been against him from the get-go. They wanted him in the beginning to win because they thought he was a weak candidate. Then he gets the nomination, and all of a sudden, he isn't such a weak candidate. He seems to be doing well. Big rallies, some polls had him well ahead in Ohio and Florida for a while. So the potential is there. If people said I could vote for Trump a month ago, they might very well vote for Trump when they show up at the poll November 8th. But I think that's been part of this milieu that has the media has been driving this election more one-sided than I've ever seen. And I think the public as a whole has started to realize that they cannot trust, believe that the media is no different than the government that has failed them. The media has failed to provide them a fair and balanced approach,
right.
And the government has failed to do their job, as evidenced by
all the breakdowns. It's a media star. That's been his strength. That's been his only strength from the beginning. And they need
strength. I think that's his strength, and that strength may not show up till November 8th.
Okay,
because there are a lot of people out there that I think are really worried about where they are in their future. And they see Hillary as a continuation of what we've seen for the last 8 years, and they see Trump as the only hope to maybe have a new approach to America.
Well, let me ask, John, do you think that there's some coordinated effort on the part of the press?
No, the press is liberal. Or do you think it's just the way they are? It's an institutional issue. We know the press is liberal. And so when they see it, they always see it through the liberal view. And that is manifest in what they generate.
Let me just, by the way, because we were talking about the dissatisfaction that Americans have. Because
you're not
a
media,
critique.
By the way. You're fair.
Right. We're fair and balanced.
Yeah.
Although, anyway, one of the things I was looking at some numbers and so on. So, for instance, Trump was talking about how China's growing. I think they're growing by 7%, India by 8%. Yeah. We're only growing by 1%. But ironically, in China, right? They only have 10% of the U.S. economy per capita. So does India, only so about 6%. Life expectancy certainly is better. Inequality is actually better. Manufacturing is actually doubled, even though a lot of it is gone overseas or been automated. John, do you think that there's some disconnect between how the economy is doing overall and how it and what reality is in the last 45 seconds or so we have here?
No, there's no question that there's a disconnect because the people in the real world are looking at expenses going up. I'm not getting paid as much. There's no job opportunity. I have to have two jobs where I used to have one. And part of that's because we've lost manufacturing, which are good paying jobs. But I think that's the reality for those people. They don't really care whether it's 1%, 2%, 3%, or 10% growth. They look at what's happening to them and their family in their situation, and it is not getting better. It's getting worse. And there's one man who theoretically is going to try and change that.
And I'm sure Mike Prettl says there's one woman who might change that too.
Exactly.
But we'll leave it at that, right?
We'll know November 9th.
Well, we've been talking to John Barkovich. He's the former chair of the Wicomico County Republican Central Committee, also Mike Prettl. He's with the local Democratic Club. And Salisbury University political science professor Mike Laughlin has joined us. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on Pac-14. To view the